Chapter 10. The neighborhood Webb was driving in was identical to most others in the area. Modest post-war homes with boxy shapes, gravel driveways, and metal awnings. The front yards were tiny, but there were big back spaces where detached garages lurked and grills sat in protected areas and split-trunk apple trees gave comforting shade. This was the land of working-class families who still took pride in their homes and never took it for granted that their children would go to college. Today, men fussed with old cars in the coolness of their garages. Women gathered on front porch stoops to drink coffee, smoke cigarettes, and exchange gossip under a sun that was very hot for this time of year and skies that were finally clear of the last storm. Kids in shorts and tennis shoes raced up and down the street on scooters that actually required one to use his legs to make it go. As he pulled up in front of Paul Romano's house, Webb could see Paulie, as everyone called him, laboring under the hood of a vintage Corvette Stingray that was his absolute pride and joy, his wife and kids rating a little farther down on the love and gush meter. Originally from Brooklyn, Paul Romano was a get-your-fingers-dirty kind of guy and fit in a neighborhood like this, with its mechanics, power linemen, truck drivers, and the like. The only difference was Romano could kill you in 100 different ways if he wanted to, and damn if there was anything you could do about it. Paul Romano was one of the ones who talked to his guns, gave them names like you would a pet. His MP5 was Freddy, as in Freddy from Nightmare on Elm Street, and his twin 45s were Cuff and Link, named after the turtles in the movie Rocky. Yes, as hard as it was to believe, Paul Romano from Brooklyn was a big Sly Stallone fan, although he was forever complaining that that damn Rambo character was one wimpy ass. Romano looked up in surprise as Webb walked over and peered into the guts of the Nassau Blue Vette with a white convertible soft top. Webb knew the car was a model year 1966, which was the first production year of the famous 427 cubic inch block engine that carried 450 horses inside, because Romano had told him and all the other HRT guys this about 1,000 times. 4-speed manual close ratio, top speed of about 165, blow anything off the street, he had said, until Webb was sick of hearing it. Police cruises, morphed street shit cans, hell, half the damn stock cars racing at the smaller tracks. Webb had often wondered what it would have felt like to be a kid pulling wrenches and tearing apart cars in the driveway with your old man. Learning stuff about carburetors, sports, women, all the things that made life worth living. Like, hey, Pop, you know how she's next to you and you're wondering, should I slip my arm around her and maybe take a chance placing my hand there? Yeah, there, Pop. Help me out. You were young once, weren't you? Don't tell me you never thought about stuff like that, because I'm standing here, aren't I? And when should I go in for the kiss? What sign should I be looking for? Pop, you won't believe this, but I can't figure these crazy women out. Does it get easier when they get older? And the old man would wink, smile knowingly, take a swig of beer, a long drag on a Marlboro, and sit down, wipe off his greasy hands on a rag, and say, okay, listen up, Junior. This is how you work it. Let me lay it out for you here, and you better write this down, because this is the gospel, son. Staring into the Corvette's chest cavity, Webb wondered what that exchange would feel like. Romano eyed Webb and didn't mention the 450 HP big block that could blow away morphed street shit cans. All he said was, beer's in the cooler, buck a can, and don't make yourself comfortable. Webb reached inside the small Coleman at his feet and popped open a Budweiser, without, however, leaving a dollar bill in payment. You know, Paulie, Bud's not all there is. Got some wicked South American brews you should try. Right, on my salary, we make the same money. I got a wife and kids, you got shit. Romano gave the socket wrench a few more pulls and then stepped past Webb and fired up the engine. It sounded powerful enough to burst through the thin metal keeping it all together. Purring like a kitten, said Webb as he sipped his beer. Hell, like a tiger. Can we talk? Got some questions. You and everybody else. Sure, come on. Got all the time in the world. What the hell am I supposed to do on my day off? Enjoy myself? So, what do you need? Some ballet tights? I'll check with my wife. You know, I'd appreciate you not ragging my ass to everybody at Quantico. And I'd appreciate you not ordering me around. And while we're at it, get the hell off my property. I got standards on people I hang with. Let's just talk, Paulie. You owe me that. Romano pointed the wrench at him. I owe you nothing, London. After 8 years doing this crap, I think we both owe each other more than we'll ever be able to cover. The two men stared at each other until Romano finally put down the wrench, wiped off his hands, turned the tiger off, and headed toward the backyard. Webb took this as an invitation to follow. Yet part of Webb was thinking that maybe Romano simply was going to the garage to get a bigger wrench to hit him with. In the backyard, the grass was cut short, the trees pruned, a fat rosebush billowed out from one side of the garage. The temperature must have been near 80 in the sun, and it felt good after all the rain. They pulled up a couple of lawn chairs and settled down. Webb watched as Romano's wife, Angie, hung clothes on the line to dry. She was from Mississippi originally. The Romanos had two kids, both boys. Angie was petite and still curvy, with big blonde hair, bewitching green eyes, and a let-me-eat-you-up-darling look. She was always flirting, always touching your arm or grazing your leg with her foot, saying that you were cute, but it was all innocent stuff. It drove Romano nuts sometimes, yet Webb could tell he really loved that other guys were attracted to his wife. That was just part of what made Romano tick. And yet when Angie Romano got pissed off, you had better look out. Webb had seen that side of her, too, at some HRT get-togethers. The little woman could be a hellcat on speed. She had made intensely confident guys who shot big guns for a living dive for cover when she was on the warpath. Paul Romano was a hotel team assaulter now, but he and Webb had come to HRT in the same class and been paired as snipers for about 3 years. Romano had been with the Deltas before joining the FBI. Though Romano was built like Webb, lacking big muscles, the muscle he did have was like cable. You couldn't break it, and the guy's motor never quit. No matter what you threw at him, he never stopped. Once, during a night raid on a drug boss's Caribbean stronghold, the assault boat had dropped Romano off too far from shore, and the guy carrying 60 pounds of gear had plunged into 15 feet of water. Instead of drowning like everybody else would have, he hit the bottom, stood, somehow got his bearings, held his breath for a mere 4 minutes, walked to shore, and participated in the attack. Because there had been a snafu in communications, and the target wasn't exactly where he was supposed to be, Romano had actually ended up nailing the drug lord himself after killing two of his bodyguards. And the only thing Romano had bitched about afterward was getting his hair wet and losing the pistol named Cuff. Romano had tattoos over most of his body, dragons, knives, and snakes, and a cute little Angie in a heart on his left biceps. Webb had run into Romano on the very first day of the HRT selection class for that year, when most of the applicants had stood, naked and scared, awaiting the terror they all knew was ahead of them. Webb had been checking out all the other guys, looking for scars on knees or shoulders that evidenced physical weakness or expressions on faces that demonstrated mental paralysis. This was both free enterprise and Darwinism at their full feverish pitch, and Webb had been looking for anything to get an edge over the competition. Webb knew that only half of them would survive the first cut that would take place in 2 weeks, and only 1 in 10 of those would get an offer to come back and really kill himself. Romano had come from the FBI's New York City SWAT team, where he had the reputation of being extremely intimidating among a group of intimidating folks. He hadn't looked scared standing in a room with 70 stripped males that first day of HRT qualifying. To Webb, he had looked like a guy who loved pain, who was just itching for HRT to start clobbering his butt with it. And the guy could dole out the hurt, too. Back then, Webb hadn't known himself if he would make the cut for the HRT slots, yet he had known from day one that Paul Romano would. The two had always been super competitive, and the guy regularly made Webb mad, but Webb had to admire the man's ability and courage. "You wanted to talk? Talk," said Romano. "Kevin Westbrook, the kid from the alley." Romano nodded at his beer. "Okay. He's missing." "The hell you say? You know Bates? Percy Bates?" "No, should I?" "He's heading up WFO's investigation. Ken McCarthy said you and Mickey Cortez were with Kevin. What can you tell me?"
"Not much."
"What did the kid say?"
"Nothing."
"So who'd you pass him off to?"
"Couple of suits."
"Get their names?"
Shake of the head.
"Hey, Paulie, you know the difference between talking to you and talking to a wall?"
"What?"
"Not a damn thing."
"What do you want me to say, Webb? I saw the kid, I watched the kid, and then the kid was gone."
"Are you telling me he didn't say one thing to you?"
"He was pretty tight-lipped. He told us his name and gave us his address. We noted that down. Mickey tried to talk to him some more, but got nothing. Hell, Cortez doesn't even talk to his own kids. See, we weren't all that sure what the boy's role in all this was. I mean, we're hauling ass to the courtyard, see your flare, and stop. Then this kid comes out of the dark with your cap and a note. I wasn't sure if he was on our side or not. I didn't want to screw up legally by asking him stuff I shouldn't."
"Okay, that was actually smart of you. But you passed him off to the suits without a word? How the hell does that compute?"
"They flashed their creds, said they were there for the kid, and that was that. It's not like we had the authority to say no. HRT doesn't do investigations, Webb. We just bang 'em and hang 'em. The suits do the snooping. And I had other things on my mind. You know, me and Teddy Reiner were in Delta together."
"I know, Paulie, I know. So about what time was that, when the suits showed up?"
Romano thought about this.
"We weren't there that long. It was still dark. Say 2:30 or so."
"Pretty efficient for WFO to get its act in order and send guys for the kid that quickly."
"So what did you want me to say to them? Hey, guys, you can't have the kid. You're way too efficient. And the FBI just doesn't work that way? Boy, that'd do wonders for my career. I could kiss my GS-14 salad days goodbye with that one."
"The suits, can you give me a description?"
Romano thought this over.
"I already told the agents."
"A bunch of other suits, so tell me. It won't kill you. Trust me."
"Right. If I was that stupid, you wouldn't have to stop at the bridge because you could sell me Brooklyn, too."
"Come on, Paulie. Assaulter to assaulter. Hotel team to what's left of Charlie."
Romano thought about this for a bit and then cleared his throat.
"One of them was a white guy. A little shorter than me, thin but wiry. Satisfied?"
"No. Hair?"
"Short and blonde. He's a Fed. What else is it going to be? You think J. Edgar walked around with a ponytail?"
"Some folks claim he did. That and a dress. Young, old, in between?"
30s. Had on your standard-issue Fed suit. Maybe a little nicer than that, actually. A lot nicer than anything you have in your closet, London.
Eyes?
He had on shades.
At 2:30 in the morning?
Well, they might have been tinted prescription glasses. I wasn't exactly going to interrogate the guy on his choice of eyewear.
You remember all that, and you can't remember the guy's name.
He flashed his creds, and I zoned out. I'm in the middle of a crime scene with people running everywhere and six of our guys with their heads blown off. He came for the kid, and he took the kid. He walked the walk and talked the talk. Hell, he probably outranked my ass.
What about his partner?
What?
His partner, the other suit. You said there were two of them.
Right. Romano didn't look so certain now. He rubbed at his eyes and sipped his beer. Well, see, that guy didn't actually come over. The one suit pointed at him, said it was his partner, and that was that. That other guy was talking to some cops, so he never actually came over.
Webb looked at him skeptically.
Pauly, that means you don't know for sure if the guy you talked to was even with that other guy. He could have been working all alone and just been blowing smoke up your butt. Did you tell the real, honest-to-God FBI all this?
Look, Webb, you were an honest-to-God fibby. You're used to investigating this kind of crap. I was a Delta. I only joined the FBI so I could jump to SWAT and then on to HRT. It's been a long time and I've forgotten how to play detective. I just bang him and hang him. Just bang him and hang him, man.
Well, you might just have hung a little boy.
Romano stared at him angrily for a few seconds and then slouched down and looked off. Webb figured Romano was thinking about his own two sons. Webb wanted the guy to feel guilty, so this blunder would never happen again.
That kid's probably in some landfill right now. He has a brother, some badass named Big F.
Don't they all, growled Romano.
Kid hasn't had much of a life. You saw the bullet hole on his cheek, at all of 10 years old.
Romano took a slug of beer and wiped his mouth.
Yeah, well, six of our guys are dead, and they shouldn't be, and I'm still wondering why it wasn't seven.
He shot Webb a nasty look as he said this.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm getting some professional help now trying to figure that out.
This was a huge admission for Webb to make, particularly to Romano, and he immediately regretted it.
Oh, yeah, that makes me feel so good. I'm gonna run through the streets yelling, Webb seeing a shrink, the world is safe.
Give me a break here, Pauly. You think I wanted to freeze out there? Do you think I wanted to see my team get shot up? Do you?
I guess you're the only one who can answer that, Romano fired back.
Look, I know this all looks bad, but why are you giving me such a hard time?
You want to know why? You really want to know why?
Yeah.
Okay, I did talk to that kid. Or let me put it better, the kid talked to me. You want to know what that kid said?
I'm sitting here, Pauly.
He said you were so scared you were bawling like a baby. He said you begged him to please don't tell anybody. You were the biggest piece of chicken shit he'd ever seen. He said you even tried to give him your gun because you were scared to use it.
Talk about your ungrateful kid. And you believe that crap?
Romano took a swig of his beer.
Well, not the part about the gun. You ain't giving that damn SR-75 to nobody.
Thanks a lot, Romano.
But the kid must have seen something to make him say stuff like that. I mean, why would he lie about everything?
Oh, I don't know, Pauly. Maybe because I'm a cop and he's just not big into law enforcement types. Why don't you go ask some of the snipers about it? They can tell you if I was crying or shooting. Or maybe you wouldn't believe them either.
Romano ignored this.
I guess people turn chicken shit all the time. Of course, I wouldn't really know about that.
You know, you're a real bastard.
Romano put down his beer and half rose out of his chair.
You want to find out how much of a bastard I really am?
The two looked to be working up to blows when Angie came over and said hello to Webb and gave him a comforting hug along with some soothing words.
Polly, she said, maybe Webb would like to stay for dinner. I'm making pork chops.
Maybe I don't want Webb to stay for damn pork chops, okay?
Growled Romano. Angie bent down and grabbed Romano's shirt, jerking him up.
Excuse us for a sec, Webb, she said.
Webb watched as Angie dragged her husband over to the side of the garage and gave him what Webb could only describe as a dressing down of intimidating proportion. She tapped her bare foot and waggled her hand in his face and did a very fine impersonation of a drill sergeant taking a serious bite out of an enlisted man's ass. And Paul Romano, who could kill just about anything that lived, just stood there, head down, and quietly took it from his little woman. Angie finally led him back over to Webb.
Go ahead, Polly, ask him.
Angie, said Webb, don't make him.
Shut up, Webb,
snapped Angie, and Webb shut up. Angie smacked the still-silent Romano on the back of the head.
Either ask him or else you'll be sleeping in the garage with that stupid car of yours.
Do you want to stay for dinner, Webb?
Asked Romano as he stared at his lawn, arms folded across his chest.
A pork chop dinner, prompted Angie. And why don't you try saying it like you actually mean it, Polly?
Would you like to stay for a pork chop dinner, Webb?
Asked Romano in the meekest little voice Webb had ever heard. And damn if he didn't even look Webb in the eye when he said it. That Angie was a miracle worker. With all Romano's suffering, how could Webb say no? Although the truth was, he was really tempted to decline the invitation just to tick the guy off.
Sure, Polly, I'll stay. Thanks for thinking of me.
As Angie went in to start dinner, the men worked on their beers and stared at the sky.
If it makes you feel any better, Angie scares the crap out of me too, Polly.
Romano looked over, and for the first time, at least in Webb's recent memory, he actually smiled. Webb looked down at his beer.
I guess you told uptown what the kid said.
Nope.
Webb glanced up, surprised. Romano just stared straight ahead.
Why not? Because it wasn't true. I appreciate that. I know when kids are lying their asses off. My own boys do it enough. I guess I was just pulling your chain. Guess that's gotten to be a habit.
But I really can't believe the kid said all that, Polly.
I saved his butt. Hell, he got lucky twice. It's only thanks to me he didn't have another bullet hole in his head.
Romano looked at him, puzzled.
That kid didn't have a bullet wound.
Sure he did, on his left cheek. And he had a knife slash on his forehead, too, long as my pinky.
Romano shook his head.
Look, Webb, I was with the kid, and maybe I wasn't paying all that much attention to him. But I wouldn't have missed something like that. I know what a bullet wound looks like because I got one of my own. And I sure as hell have popped enough guys to know what they look like.
Webb sat up very straight.
What was his skin color?
What the hell are you talking about? What was his skin color? He was black.
Damn it, I know that, Polly. I mean light-skinned, dark.
Light-skinned, smooth as a baby's ass, and not a mark on him. From my lips to the Pope, I swear.
Webb smacked the arm of the chair.
Damn.
Kevin Westbrook, at least the one Webb had run into, had chocolate brown skin. After dinner with the Romanos, Webb visited Mickey Cortez and got the same story. He'd heard no other statements from the kid,
No ID on the suit who had taken him away, but corroboration on the time. And no bullet wound on the boy's cheek. So who had made the kid switch? And why? Chapter 11. Fred Watkins climbed out of his car after another long day for the U.S. attorney. It took him an hour and a half to drive into Washington each day from his Northern Virginia suburb, and about the same coming home. 90 minutes to drive barely 10 miles. He shook his head at the thought of it. His work wasn't over either. Despite having risen at 4 a.m. and having labored 10 hours already today, he had at least another 3 hours awaiting him in the small study he used as an office in his house. A little dinner and some brief quality time with his wife and teenage kids, and he would burn the midnight oil. Watkins specialized in high-profile racketeering cases at the Department of Justice in Washington, after a long stint as a humble Commonwealth's attorney in Richmond, prosecuting whatever miscreants came his way. He enjoyed the work and felt he was doing a real service for his country. He was reasonably well compensated for doing so, and though the hours were sometimes long, his life had turned out all right, he believed. His oldest would be going off to college in the fall, and in another 2 years, so would his youngest child. He and his wife had plans for traveling then, seeing parts of the world they had only viewed in travel magazines. Watkins also had visions of taking an early retirement and teaching as an adjunct professor of law at the University of Virginia, where he had received his degree. He and his wife were thinking of maybe even moving to Charlottesville someday permanently and escaping forever the traffic dungeon that Northern Virginia had become. He rubbed his neck and breathed in the fresh air of a nice, cool evening. A good plan overall. At least he and his wife had a plan. Some of his colleagues patently refused to think beyond tomorrow, much less years from now. But Watkins had always been a practical, commonsensical man. That's how he had always approached his law practice, and that's how he dealt with life. He closed the car door and headed up the sidewalk to his house. On the way, he waved to a neighbor pulling out of her driveway. Another neighbor was grilling next door, and the smell of cooking meat filled his nostrils. He might just fire up the barbecue tonight, too. Like most people in the Washington area, Watkins had read about the ambush of the hostage rescue team unit with great interest and sinking despair. He had worked with some of those folks on a case once and had nothing but good things to say about their bravery and professionalism. Those guys were the best, at least in his book, and they did a job that virtually no one else would be willing to do. Watkins had thought he had had it tough until he saw what those fellows went through. He felt especially sorry for their families, and was even thinking about inquiring if a fund had been established to help them. If there wasn't such a fund, Watkins was thinking about starting one. Just another item to add to the old to-do list, but that's just how life worked, he guessed. He never saw it until it rose from the bushes and charged right at him. Watkins yelled out and then ducked. The bird missed him by inches. It was the same damn blue jay. The thing seemed to lie in wait for him most nights, as though trying its best to scare him into a premature coronary. "Not this time," said Watkins to the fleeing creature. "Not ever. I'll get you before you get me." He chuckled and walked up to the front porch. As he opened the front door, his cell phone rang. Now what, he thought. Few people had this number. His wife, but she wouldn't be calling him because she had no doubt seen him pull in the driveway. It had to be the office. And if it was the office, that meant something had happened that would probably take up the remainder of his evening,
and perhaps even require him to turn around and drive back into town. He pulled out his phone, saw that caller ID was unavailable, and thought about not answering it. But that just wasn't how Fred Watkins did things. It might be important, yet maybe it was just a wrong number. No barbecuing tonight, he thought, as he punched the talk button, ready to confront whatever it was. They found what remained of Fred Watkins in the neighbor's bushes across the street, where the blast that disintegrated his house had delivered him. The instant he'd hit the talk button, a tiny spark from his phone ignited the gas that had filled his house, gas that Watkins had little chance of detecting when he opened the door because of the smells of grilling meat next door. Somehow, his briefcase had survived, still clamped in a hand that was now virtually all bone. The precious papers were intact and ready for another attorney to take over from the deceased lawyer. The bodies of his wife and children were found in the wreckage. Autopsies would show that all of them had already died from asphyxiation. It took 4 hours to extinguish the fire, and two other homes were engulfed before the conflagration was put out. Thankfully, no other people were seriously injured. Only the Watkins family had ceased to exist. The question of how he and his wife would spend their retirement years after a lifetime of hard work was laid to rest with them. They had no problem finding Watkins' phone because it had melted to his hand. At about the time Fred Watkins' life was ending, 90 miles south in Richmond, Judge Louis Ledbetter was climbing into the back of a government car under the watchful eye of a United States Marshal. Ledbetter was a federal trial judge, a position he had held for 2 years after being elevated from being chief judge of the Richmond Circuit Court. Because of his relative youth, he was only 46, and his exceptional legal ability, many folks in powerful places had their eye on Ledbetter as eventually a candidate for the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, and perhaps even one day taking his seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. As a judge in the legal trenches, Ledbetter had overseen many trials of varying complexity, emotion, and potential volcanic eruption. Several men that he had sentenced to prison had threatened his life. Once he had almost fallen prey to a letter bomb sent by a white supremacist organization that hadn't cared for Ledbetter's steadfast belief that all persons, regardless of creed, color, or ethnicity, were equal under the eyes of God and the law. These circumstances dictated that Ledbetter receive additional security, and there had been a recent development that had further increased concerns for his safety. There had been a daring prison escape by a man who had sworn revenge on Ledbetter. The prison where the man had been held was very far away, and the threats were from several years ago, yet the authorities were wisely taking no chances with the good judge. For his part, Ledbetter simply wanted to live his life as he always had, and the beefed-up security was not particularly appealing to him. However, having barely escaped death once, he was practical enough to realize that the concern was probably legitimate. And he didn't want to die violently at the hands of some piece of filth who should be rotting away in prison. Judge Ledbetter wouldn't want to give the man the satisfaction. "Any news on Free?" he asked the U.S. Marshal. That the man who had escaped from prison was named Free had always rankled Ledbetter. Ernest B. Free. The middle initial and surname weren't his real ones, of course. He had had his name legally changed when he had joined a paramilitary neoconservative group whose members all had taken that name as symbolism of the perceived threats to their liberty. In fact, the group called themselves the Free Society.
ironic, since they were violent and intolerant of anyone who didn't look like them or who disagreed with their hate-filled beliefs. They were the type of organization that America could certainly do without, and yet they were also an example of the vastly unpopular types of groups that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution was constructed to afford protection to. But not when such groups killed. No, not when they killed. No bit of paper, no matter how cherished, could protect you from the consequences of that. Free and other members of his group had broken into a school, shot two teachers to death, and taken numerous children and teachers hostage. Local authorities had surrounded the school, and a SWAT team had been called up, but Free and his men were heavily armed with automatic weapons and body armor. Thus, federal lawmen specializing in hostage rescue had been called up from Quantico. At first, things looked like they would end peacefully, but shooting had erupted from inside the school, and eventually the hostage rescue team had gone in. A horrific gun battle had ensued. Ledbetter could still vividly recall the heartbreaking sight of a young boy lying dead on the pavement along with two teachers. A wounded Ernest B. Free had finally given up when his accomplices had been gunned down. There had been some question as to whether Free would be tried in federal or state courts. While it was believed that the school was targeted because it was a cutting-edge magnet school for integration and enhancement of race relations, and Free's racist views were well known, it still would have been hard to prove, Ledbetter recognized. To start with, the three people killed, the two teachers and the young boy, were white, and thus prosecuting Free under a federal hate crime statute looked relatively weak. And while technically Free could have been charged with assaults on federal officers, it seemed the best shot was to make things simple and try him in state court and seek the death penalty for the multiple murders. The result was not one any of them had intended. "No, Judge," replied the marshal, snapping Ledbetter out of his reminiscing. The marshal had been looking out for Ledbetter for a while now, and they had quickly established a good rapport. "If you ask me, that man's plan is to head to Mexico and then on to South America, hook up with some Nazis, people of his own kind." "Well, I hope they get him and put him right back where he belongs," said Ledbetter. "Oh, they probably will. Feds are on it, and they sure got the resources. I wanted that bastard to get the death penalty. That's what he deserved." It was one of the few regrets that Ledbetter had as a circuit court judge. But Free's defense counsel had, of course, raised the issue of insanity and even tiptoed along the fringe of alleging a claim of brainwashing by the cult, as he had described the organization Free belonged to. The attorney was just doing his job, and in the minds of the prosecution, it apparently had raised just enough doubt about the odds of a solid conviction that they had struck a deal with Free's counsel before the jury had come back in. Instead of a potential death penalty, Free had gotten 20 to life with the possibility, however slight, that he might someday be paroled. Ledbetter hadn't agreed with the deal, yet he really had no choice but to sign off on it. The media had taken an informal poll of the jury later. Free had the real last laugh then. All jury members would have voted for conviction, and all would have recommended the death penalty. The press had had a field day with that one. Everyone had ended up with egg on his face. Free had been transferred for a variety of reasons to a maximum security prison in the Midwest. That was the place he had escaped from. Ledbetter looked over at his briefcase. Folded neatly inside was a copy of his beloved New York Times. Ledbetter had been born and attended school in New York City before heading south and settling in Richmond. The transplanted Yankee loved his new home, but each evening when he got home, exactly 1 hour was spent reading the Times. It had been his habit for all his years on the bench, and his copy was specially delivered to the courthouse before he left each day. It was one of the few acts of relaxation the man was able to enjoy anymore. As the marshal drove out of the court's garage, his phone rang, and he answered it.
"What's that?"
"Yes, sir, Judge."
"Yes, sir, I'll tell him."
He put the phone down and said,
"That was Judge Mackey. He said to tell you to look at the last inside page of the front section of the Times if you want to see something really amazing."
"Did he say what it was?"
"No, sir, just that you were to look and then to call him right back."
Ledbetter glanced at the paper, his curiosity running high. Mackey was a good friend, and his intellectual interests ran similar to Ledbetter's. If Mackey thought something fascinating, probably so would he. They were stopped at a light now. That was good, because Ledbetter couldn't read in a moving car without getting violently ill. He pulled the paper out, but it was too dark to see in the car. He reached over and turned on the reading light switch and opened the paper. The annoyed marshal looked back and said,
"Judge, I told you not to be turning that light on. It makes you a dern sitting duck."
The tinkle of glass stopped the marshal cold. That and the sight of Judge Louis Ledbetter toppling face down onto his precious New York Times, its pages now soiled with his blood.